Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Before we get stuck into this week's podcast, which is all about Formula One, I just want to do my now customary Patreon shout out, because Drive Nation is now on Patreon. If you don't know, that effectively means that content creators like us can ask our supporters to contribute a little bit of money each month just to help to grow DN, to help help us reach a bigger audience and make it more sustainable, bring in other voices and so on. For everyone who does contribute to Patreon, and you can choose exactly how much you want to contribute, they get exclusive written content. And I think we shared some good stuff so far up on Patreon. That's patreon.com/DriveNation. Please do support us if you can. And finally, a big thank you to everybody who has supported us so far. It really does mean a lot. I'll leave it there. I could bang on about Patreon for a long time, but it's probably not that interesting to listen to. So we'll talk about something more interesting. Formula One. Andrew.
Hello, Dan. Sorry, yes, I was enjoying listening to you wax lyrical about Patreon so much, I forgot to speak. Yes, Formula One. It's not because I think the forthcoming season is going to be terminally tedious or anything. But yes, no, we have a rather belated new season of Formula One coming up, starting this weekend in Austria, with a double header. The second one the following weekend being the Styrian GP.
And presumably this is because no single country can host two Grand Prix in the same year.
Not on the same, no, I think that's exactly right.
It's a technicality, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Which is why when it goes to Silverstone on the 2nd and 9th of August, the first one is the British Grand Prix, and the second one is the 70th anniversary Grand Prix, the 70th anniversary of Formula One, which did indeed kick off at Silverstone in 1950.
They got lucky with that, didn't they? That coronavirus they did, didn't they? Hit. That was fortuitous, actually.
Yes. I should say now.
Go on.
Top fact is that Silverstone, or the British Grand Prix, and Italian Grand Prix are the only Grand Prix which have run every single year since the start of the Formula One World Championship in 1950. Now, obviously, the Italian Grand Prix has been at Monza, but not always, and the British Grand Prix has largely been at Silverstone, but also not always. But in terms of countries, Britain and Italy are the only ones to have held Grand Prix every single year. There you go. Top trivia over.
Good knowledge. Good knowledge. Okay, so we have got the start of the severely delayed start of the 2020 season coming up this weekend. So it's a good opportunity to sort of quite briefly look forward to this new season, but also
or not look forward to it.
Well, or not look forward to it, just wish it away, I suppose. And also think about Formula One more broadly. Have a look at the technical regulations that are coming in a couple of years, and ask what Formula One needs to do to fix itself, if it needs to fix itself at all. I suspect Andrew thinks it does. Okay, so it's 7 months Andrew, since anybody has raced a Formula One car.
Wow.
We've had winter testing.
Yeah.
And a few of the teams have been out in the last couple of weeks, haven't they, in older cars just to let the drivers knock off the rust. But nobody has raced an F1 car for 7 months. And I wonder when that was last the case. I mean...
Maybe
several decades ago.
I don't know the answer to the question, but I mean, I don't imagine that there has been that layoff since before Formula One started. I mean, you'd have to have a season that sort of, you know, ended in sort of August, September time, didn't start again until March, April. So maybe someone can tell us. I don't know. My strong suspicion is that there has never been a seven month layoff. And it'll be interesting, won't it? Do you think that'll actually affect drivers, or do you think they'll just get in the car and they'll kind of go out and first practice and go, oh yeah, this is how you do it, and then it'll just be like they've never been away?
I don't know, and that's why I'm kind of intrigued by it. I suppose they're so professional, aren't they, that it'll be visor down, FP1, and they'll just get straight back into it, and it will feel like any other race weekend.
I can remember, the only insight I can provide into this, I can remember having a conversation with Damon Hill sometime after he retired, and he said that, and he was talking about testing, not racing, but you know, they still have a winter layoff, and he'd get back in the car at the first test in the new year, and he'd get back in the car and he'd think to himself, I've forgotten how to do this. This thing is a complete animal. It's just trying to kill me. I can't do this. I got to retire. I mean, how did I ever drive these things? And then by the end of that session, he'd be shouting at his engineers because the car didn't have enough power, the handling was all to shit, and it was like he'd never been away. I think these guys are that good that despite the utterly extraordinary things that they get in and drive, I think they can just pick it up almost, maybe not absolutely immediately, but I think I'd be amazed if there's any rustiness, certainly come by the time even quali takes place, let alone the race.
Anyway, they'll be perfectly sharp, Andrew, because of all the sim racing they've been doing.
Yes, exactly. All the sim racing. Yes, and all the sim racing I've been watching them doing. Good luck to them for that. But of course, yeah, actually, it is a point. They will have been presumably all doing that. And, you know, well, yeah, great.
Okay, let's not get stuck into that again. All right. So, okay, let's have a little think about this 2020 season, which is going to be an odd one. I mean, many, many Grand Prix simply aren't happening at all.
Yeah.
Most obviously, no Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And plenty of others besides. There were moments when it looked like there might not be any British Grand Prix, and now we've got two, or at least we've got the British Grand Prix and the 70th anniversary Grand Prix at the same track the following weekend.
But the amount of times, you know, because I'm quite a lot older than you, the amount of times the British Grand Prix has been absolutely on the point of not happening, and then it happens. The thing is, as I said, it's never not happened, despite the fact that, you know, the BRDC are always falling out with the F1 rights holders and this, that, and the other, and yet somehow it always happens.
It happens.
And actually it's happening twice this year. So yeah, that's going to be a great one for the trivia fans in years to come, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. So this new season that we have, I mean, we've got 8 Grand Prix confirmed so far, and apparently they're actually aiming for 15 or 18
something like that, in
all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's going to be a very busy latter half of the year, isn't it, for the Formula One teams? And if they manage to pull off 18 races, well, that'll just feel like a full season of F1 racing, won't it? But there's an interesting point. The season gets underway with 2 back-to-back Grand Prix at the Red Bull Ring. Now, Andrew, presumably you think that we're looking at more or less a repeat of the 2019 season and the 18 and the 17 season and many more before that, with Lewis in the Mercedes dominating and romping off to a 7th title.
Okay, so the question you have to ask yourself is, why isn't that going to happen? What has happened? Okay, Lewis is a year older, and he's not a youngster anymore, but he's always been one of the fittest guys out there. So I just don't. And also, the cars aren't as physically taxing to drive now as they once were. So I don't believe that's going to be a factor. So what's changed? You know, he is the best driver. You know, the cars are going to be extremely similar. because the regs have been tied down for so long. So is someone really going to have, you know, found something amazing? Lewis will also have for this year, I believe, you know, that crazy steering system, the in-out push-me-pull-you steering column, which alters the toe of the front width. That's banned for next year, but I think he can use it this year.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not saying, because Formula One does have a strange way of, and thank goodness for that, throwing the odd curve ball at you, but all I'm saying now is I can't see a reason why Lewis won't be champion again and won't do it reasonably easily. Maybe Ferrari, particularly with Leclerc now fully bedded at the team, will give them a more run for his money. I don't believe that Bottas is going to be any threat to Lewis at all. Maybe the Red Bull is gonna come good with Max, but I mean, I don't see it. I think we're gonna have, even then, hopefully we'll have some really, really interesting races. You know, it's great that some circuits, some of the really good circuits like Silverstone and Spa and Monza, and hopefully Suzuka will still be on the calendar. And it's always those old traditional circuits that tend to give the best races. So there may be some really good racing to watch. But as far as the final outcome is concerned, you know, I wouldn't say I'd be amazed, but I'd be very surprised if Lewis wasn't champion again.
Okay, all I have to say is this, and I say this because actually I'm a huge Hamilton fan. I want him to win that seventh title in 2020, and I say this because I don't want to be complacent and then be disappointed if something unforeseen does happen. But I think Lewis's success recently has come from sort of metronomic consistency, from rhythm. And that rhythm has been massively interrupted during this whole COVID-19 thing and the delayed start of the 2020 season. Also, with the first two races at the Red Bull Ring, that's a very, very tricky start for the Mercedes team. Lewis has won that race once ever. And Max has won it the last 2 years.
Funnily enough, in a Red Bull, you're not suggesting skullduggery, are you?
No, I wouldn't. not at all. But, you know, if we carry that form over, Max has a flyer, starts the season with a bang, wins the first two Grand Prix.
Yeah.
You know, Lewis perhaps his car isn't competitive around that circuit. And then all of a sudden, there's a very different complexion to the season.
You see, I mean, part of me hopes you're right. I mean, I've been a bit, I've blown a bit hot and cold on Lewis over the years, but I think that at the moment, he is one of the greatest drivers this sport has ever seen. And it's exactly what you say. He never makes a mistake. I mean, I can't remember, you know, last season, whether he even spun a car in a qualifying session or anything. And when he goes wheel to wheel with someone, there is no one like him out there. And he's in the best car and everything else. But the thing about Mercedes is, you know, they've often had slightly shaky starts to season. But it's, you know, and there have been lots of times when everybody said, oh, well, Ferrari have got them this time. And guess what? By the end of the season, they've just turned it around, because it's more than just about designing a quick car. There have been at least two seasons recently where they've not had the quickest car and they've still won the championship. You know, they understand it's more about having a fast driver in the fast car. They understand the concept of team better than anybody. And that's why, you know, you may well find that, you know, Red Bull on home territory do very well. But, you know, even in a curtailed season, both in terms of number of races and the period of time over which it elapses, which obviously gives less time for the car to develop, I still think that by the end of it, I can't see sufficient reason to think that a Mercedes with Lewis driving it isn't going to be on the top step again.
Yeah, and the other thing as well is that the Mercedes team, operationally, it's been pretty flawless, and the same has not been true, certainly, of Ferrari.
No.
Which has actually perhaps been the difference between them. Okay, well, on the subject of Ferrari, before we move on from the 2020 season, let's just have a quick think about Seb Vettel, because he's on his way out from Ferrari.
Yeah.
He's going to be pretty keen, isn't he, to demonstrate that he hasn't lost it, that he's still worthy of a top ride?
Yeah, no, absolutely he is. But, you know, but what we have... You know, and I speak as a Vettel fan. I have been. I mean, I know that his conduct hasn't been great at times, but I think I think he's a bloke whose heart's in the right place, who lets himself down every so often. But I think fundamentally he's one of the good guys. But what we do know is that when it starts to matter to him, when it gets important, he feels pressure, and when he feels pressure, he makes mistakes. So he has to have a more grown up approach to the season. And Leclerc, who is absolutely the heir apparent, he's not going to be going, after you, Seb, because there's always 2021 for me. He is going to be up and at him from the get go because he won't be
thinking. Well, it's his team now, isn't it?
Yeah, and he won't be thinking of Seb, he'll be thinking about Lewis. Absolutely. Vettel wants to leave the sport with his somewhat tarnished reputation boosted and in a better place than it is now. But it's a risk. And it wouldn't be a risk for every driver, but for him, who does feel the pressure and does make a mistake when he feels the pressure, he's got to get the balance right.
There's a lot to look forward to. Well, at least I hope there is. I mean,
me too.
It might well turn out to be more of the same, but I'm just glad that we've got Formula One racing back. It's been a long, long layoff. One of the frustrations of this whole COVID-19 situation from a Formula One point of view is that the new set of regulations, they've been delayed. They were going to come in at the start of the 2021 season. Now they're not coming in until 22, which is a real pity because it just means we've got, more of the same this year and then more of the same next season as well.
Well, except if I can just say that in 21, we do have the budget cap.
That does come in for 21.
Yeah,
then.
So I believe. Someone will now tell me that I'm wrong, but I believe the budget cap comes in 21. And it's only the technical regulations that have been held until 22. So that's interesting, isn't it? But then again, you have the budget cap for 2021. That means if it starts on Jan 1, I don't know when it actually starts. By that stage, the development of the 2021 cars has already been done. Before the caps come in. So I don't think you'll start seeing the effect of the budget cap really until 22.
So it's the same thing really, isn't it?
Well, I mean, to an extent. I don't know if it's a good time to talk about the budget cap, but the budget cap at the moment is it's going to be $145 million per team. That's what you can spend. And if you think that the top teams are spending anything up to $400 million at the moment, certainly Mercedes is spending probably more than that. Ferrari, not a lot less than that. And Red Bull, not a lot less than that. That sounds like a massive difference. However, there are exclusions. So the money doesn't include what you pay your top drivers. It doesn't include your marketing budget. It doesn't include the salaries of your top three executives, and it only does include stuff done to make the car go faster. Okay, so there is a whole world of interpretation out there, and clever ways and creative accounting, all sorts of things that people will be able to do, teams will be able to do, to shuffle money from one pot to another to make it look like they have kept within the rules. And the one thing that we know people in Formula One are better at than anything else in the world is getting around the rules.
Bending those rules.
Yeah, so I mean, call me a cynic, but I think they will, all the teams, particularly the top teams, will be employing people specifically at the moment for no purpose other than find ways of not breaking these rules but getting around them. And so let's see just how effective it really is.
Interesting. Yeah, so maybe Toto Wolff takes a £30 million pay rise and just happens to buy for his own purpose a full-scale wind tunnel or something.
I mean, you can see there's going to be so much fun in games. There's going to be so much fun. I mean, the law of unintended consequences is going to kick in Formula One. Like, I suspect, like, we've never seen it before.
Yeah, those forensic accountants are going to have to be on it as well. But also the Formula One journalistic core, they're going to have to really do some digging and try and keep on top of all this.
Yeah, they are. They are.
Interesting. Yeah, so I think this budget cap is a very good move because, well, we've seen it for the last few seasons of Formula One racing. There are currently only three teams that are rich enough to win races. That's the reality, isn't it?
The reality is that for 7 years, over 7 years now, the first race of 2013 was the last time anything other than a Mercedes, a Red Bull or Ferrari won a race. And you, of course, will be able to tell me who it was and what he was in.
But it was I don't know.
Kimi Räikkönen in a Renault masquerading as a Lotus. There you go.
That's a, I was going to say that, but so I thought it sounded wrong.
That was totally unfair of me. But yeah, but I mean, 7 years. 7 years. I mean, that's, you know, that's a career. Yeah? Easily, for most people, for a lot of people, that's a career in Formula One. Gone. And if you weren't in one of those three teams, you know, if they didn't crash or fall off or whatever, you know, normally expectations is that the best you can expect for is to come seventh. And that's your career. And, you know, and that to me is fundamentally what is wrong with Formula One. Is the gap between the biggest and the smallest is wider than it's ever been. And you can see it in on the way the cars perform, and you can see it in the number of cars on the track.
Yeah, yeah, and the idea of this budget cap is to try and level that playing field, and so that if you're an Aston Martin taking over the racing point, or if you're a Williams or a Haas, you have a much better chance of competing with a Mercedes or a Ferrari or a Red Bull, and it's very clever actually to exclude certain things from that budget cap, marketing budget and so on, driver salaries, because it does mean that if you are a Mercedes and you want to leverage your F1 racing, you can spend as much as you like marketing it. But if you're a Williams or a Haas and you exist actually just to go racing, all your money can be spent on racing, and you're spending, in theory, as much as the top teams are. Hopefully, that levels the playing field, and we find ourselves with maybe six teams that can win races. It would just turn the sport on its head, wouldn't it?
It has that potential. And the other good thing about the cap is that it's a sliding scale. I can't remember the numbers, but you know, $145 million is where it starts, and it comes down from there. I mean, I would be happier for it to come down to, you know, $100 million, because these are still unimaginable numbers to me. But you know, maybe I don't know the way the world works. But you know, we have a situation at the moment where there are, you know, 20 cars on the grid, and yet you've got McLaren apparently on its knees, mortgaging its historic race cars just so that it can survive. You know, you've got Williams saying, well, you know, completely up for sale, and saying, you know, and having to issue reassurances that they can actually get their cars to the grid this year. You know, these aren't, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, you know, little teams you forget about 5 minutes later. This is McLaren and Williams. These are two of the greatest names. You know, probably the two greatest British names in the history of, you know, Formula One. And they're both, you know, absolutely on the limit, struggling to survive in the sport. And if that doesn't tell you there's something wrong with it, I don't know what does.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's not be flippant, though. I mean, $145 million, still a huge amount of money. And you know Gunther Steiner will be looking at that going, well, where am I going to find the other $45 million? There we go. That's just Formula One, I suppose. So we're looking forward to that cost cap coming in, the budget cap coming in, hopefully leveling the playing field. But I think even more than that, we're looking forward to the 2022 regulation changes, delayed for a season, supposed to come in 2021, instead coming in 22. Now, I mean, that and the budget cap, we'll go into some more detail on the regulation changes in a moment, but between them, wow, they really could change the face of F1 racing. We really could see much more overtaking, many, many more cars and drivers capable of scoring podiums and victories. And more than, you know, just the two or three drivers we've had recently in title contention. I mean, wow, we're potentially looking at a properly competitive category again.
And the brilliant thing, yeah, you know, the thing that I am most excited about is, you know, other teams who look at Formula One at the moment and think, you know, $400 million to get, you know, to compete at the top level, forget it. You know, make that 80 or 100 million. And, you know, there are lots of really, really good teams, you know, in F2 and F3 who may be beginning to think, well, you know, we've got some sponsors who quite fancy a bit of that, and maybe we could get on that. And then suddenly, you know, I'm getting, you know, sorry, I'll bang on about my age, but I'm more than old enough to remember, you know, times when, you know, where you had, you know, a large number of cars in Formula One that didn't even, you know, there were so many cars that they had to have pre-qualifying, and lots of those didn't even get to race at the weekend because you had teams literally queuing up to race. And you had bulging grids. And you know, the thing is, if you've got, you know, 30 or 32 cars on a grid instead of 20, you've got half as many cars again. You've gone up 50%. You know, that's, you know, the opportunity for interesting stuff to happen just gets multiplied actually by a more than commensurate amount. Because cars, you know, cars are in traffic more often. They start tangling with each other more often. There's more lapping going on. There's just all sorts of stuff going on. And what happens is the racing gets more interesting. So anything that gets more teams into the sport and allows the teams that are already there to survive, it's got to be good.
Talking of making the racing more interesting, let's have a quick look at these new regulations coming in 22. So the whole point of it is to more or less maintain current downforce levels. So the cars will pretty much be as quick as they are, I suppose. But the idea is to generate that downforce with the underside of the car rather than all the aerodynamic devices on top of the car. The idea being to reduce the wake, the turbulence behind it, so that a following car doesn't lose so much downforce, so that it's easier to follow and chase and therefore try and overtake. Very interesting numbers, actually. The new regulations, the design of the new cars will apparently mean that a following car will only lose 14% of its downforce, whereas today it's 45%. So if you're in a Formula One car and you're coming up behind another car and you get in its wake, you've lost almost half your downforce. And that's why drivers find it so hard to get close enough to mount an attack. But I mean, just imagine that if they only lose 14%, that's some racing again.
It is, and it's, you know, and it's a great step. It really is a great step. But my question is, you know, why do you have to have all that downforce in the first place? You know, if you wanted to have really great racing, what you do is you just restrict downforce full stop. You wouldn't say, well, we'll just change it from on top of the car to underneath the car. You'd stop it altogether, because what you would then do, let's say you doubled braking distances from high speed.
Yes, yeah? true.
How much overtaking are you going to get there? I'm not sure. I don't understand the great God downforce. I don't understand why people, the organisers and the teams, I suppose it's because where the big teams feel that they can most easily extract a competitive advantage by being very clever. And the other thing is that, you know, we know that, you know, what happens or what has happened in the past when you've had, I mean, you know, effectively cars are going to go back to ground effect, which lots of people listening to this will remember. From the late 1970s and the 1980s until it got banned. And it got banned for a very good reason, because the cars were becoming undrivable. You know, you had cars with generating so much downforce under the car, they basically had no spring rate at all. The drivers all hated them. And I think everybody breathed a massive sigh of relief when it all got banned. So, you know, I'm not saying that they can't be better at it now, that it won't be more sophisticated, but I completely get the overtaking thing with the turbulence behind the car, but in terms of moving the downforce from above it to below it, there is some sense to me, as someone who is not, you know, technically qualified or an engineer in any sense, of nevertheless of robbing Peter to pay Paul a bit. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, perhaps you're right. Perhaps you're right. And I think it's Tiff Nadell who makes a very interesting point about motorsport, and he says, If just one car going through a corner is entertaining to watch, you've got a good discipline. You've got a good category there. Because if you have many cars going through that same corner, racing wheel to wheel, well, it'll just be spectacular. If one car going through a corner on its own just looks locked down and totally pinned to the track, you know, it's perhaps not such a spectacle. What I would say, though, is I'm sure you've seen it as well. When you're standing at you know, the right section of the right track, a really quick corner, and you see the speed that a Formula One car goes through there, you think you're watching something in fast forward, don't you? It's astonishing.
It is breathtaking. You know, if you are, you know, rich enough to be able to get to the circuit and pay for the exorbitantly expensive grandstand ticket, which will be positioned on the outside of those, you know, for those lucky people, an extraordinary sight. I don't think it's any less extraordinary, frankly, than, you know, going to Le Mans and just climbing up onto a bank free of charge and seeing proper prototypes go through corners. But it is. But is it as extraordinary as watching, you know, what Tiff was talking about? You know, a stream of cars all quite clearly on the limit, because they're oversteering and understeering, and you can see the drivers, you know, fighting at the wheel and that sort of thing. To me, that is a more entertaining spectacle, and you can still have all of that and keep the cars fast just by trading aerodynamic grip for mechanical grip. And you know, that is, you know, that's not a new idea. People have been talking about that, you know, frankly, ever since you know, ground effect and big downforce came in. But you know, I still don't really understand the argument against it, because Tiff is absolutely right. You know, for Formula One to look interesting, cars have to look interesting in the way they go around a track. And, you know, and the telly always slows things down, doesn't it? And I'm
That's the other thing. You lose that spectacle through the TV.
You do. And I just think, you know, hopefully they will become more interesting to look at and the overtaking will get better. But you know, I want them to be absolutely riveting. You know, I mean, I want them to look like, I want to be able to see a driver do his job. I think that's what it is. And this was my problem with the Halo. And I understand the Halo and I understand the requirement for it and everything else. But it's just another bar. It's like when they put high sides on the cars after Senna's accidents. And I completely understand that and wouldn't question that for a second. But the further you put the driver away from the viewer, the less easy it is to see what he's up to. But at least if the car's attitude is changing and you can see hands soaring at a wheel, you can see that car is absolutely on the limit. Now, we all know that Lewis, when he, you know, goes into poo on Spa on a qualifying lap, he's absolutely on the limit. But yeah, it may not look that way. And I think the cars have to do more than just be fast. I think they need to look fast too for it to become a proper spectacle again.
Yep, you're quite right. With the very high sides, the very tight cockpit, the halo there, and particularly on a dry circuit when the car is pinned to the ground, you can almost forget there's a person in there at all.
And sorry to bang on a little bit, but that's the thing, isn't it? You know, we, I don't think, in the main, love Formula One for the machinery, or indeed any sport for the machinery. We don't love, you know, tennis for Roger Federer's racket, do we? You know, it's the people. That's what matters. They are our heroes. It is their skill, it is their talent that we pay, either by going to a track or turning on our telly and paying a license fee or a Sky sub or whatever. That's what we see. And the more barriers you put between us and what we love, which is watching, you know, extraordinary, exceptionally gifted human beings do stuff we can barely imagine, the less of a spectacle you're going to have. And I think at the moment, you know, everybody's thinking about the machinery and, you know, and speed and that sort of thing. And missing the fundamental point, which is what I said earlier about, you know, the cars have to do more than be fast. They have to look fast too, because that's the way we see our heroes doing their stuff.
Yeah. And as we alluded to earlier, on the 9th of August at Silverstone, there will be the 70th anniversary Grand Prix, because this being 2020, it's the 70th year of Formula One, first year in 1950. So it's quite a good opportunity to sort of reflect and look back, particularly as we're having a bit of a moan and a grumble about modern F1 racing. When do you think, Andrew, the Formula One racing was at its best? When were the technical regulations and the technology, when did they converge to sort of deliver the most spectacular racing and the most exciting cars to watch?
It's a really difficult question to answer, and I don't mean that in terms of I'm not sure. I mean, it's because it is such a bittersweet double-edged thing, because frankly, Formula One was at its most interesting when it was also at its most dangerous.
Exactly right.
And you can't divorce the two. You know, I can sit there and go on about three-litre DFV cars of the late 60s and early 70s, and weren't they wonderful watching them oversteer around the place? And that's when men were men and everything else. But, you know, a lot of people died. And you can't forget that. And, you know, society has decided, and I understand this as well, that is no longer an acceptable price to pay in a way that it was back then. So it's really difficult, because
just on that,
yeah.
This is very relevant. I was in a room once when Max Verstappen was asked which era of Formula One he would most like to have raced in, and he said, "This one. The cars are the fastest and they're the safest. So obviously this one." And you think, "Yeah, okay, good point."
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say something which is, I hope people don't take this the wrong way, but danger is, nobody wants to see anyone get hurt, let alone, God forbid, get killed. But the problem is that the moment you make these things completely safe, you sanitize the sport and you compromise the spectacle. And, you know, I, as some will know, I do a lot of historic car racing, which is, you know, those cars aren't particularly safe. But the thing is, and the thing has always been to me, when there's been some big crash somewhere, but, you know, it often happens at Goodwood where someone, you know, gets hurt in a revival and some people say you shouldn't be racing those sorts of things. To me, if you knowing those, the risk that you take, you get in the car and you go out there, then that's your business, isn't it? That's what you have decided to do, and you do it because you love doing it and you have decided that for you those risks are acceptable. You know, no one is making you get in the car. And if you don't like that, you don't have to do it. Now, you know, I think that there is a way of providing the spectacle in modern Formula One without materially making it more dangerous, because the cars themselves are so safe. And I'm not saying for a moment you should stop building cars out of bent metal again, because that would be clearly ridiculous. But for instance, you know, you shouldn't have these massive runoff areas where people can just throw their cars off the circuit and onto effectively what is another circuit made out of tarmac and drive straight back onto it again. You know, there should be consequences, because that's when, you know, it's another way of illustrating a driver's skill. And I just think that it's just gone too far the other way. Obviously, you can't possibly have any risk to any member of the public. But to those who are doing it of their own volition, I just think that there should be consequences. I'm not saying more than that, but there should be more consequences in terms of maybe the car retiring or getting stuck in a trap or something, you know, than there are at the moment, because it's too easy to push your car too far and for it not to matter. And, you know, and if you talk to the, you know, to certainly, you know, lots of the guys who used to race years ago, they'll tell you a similar thing, I think. So yeah, there you go, I've said it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you know, we don't even have to bring the barriers closer to the circuit so that drivers hit those if they run off the track. I think gravel traps, I mean, they've all been torn out and tarmac poured in, but gravel traps are perhaps the solution. You know, if you run wide, you drop a wheel into one, you might spin off, you might get beached, you might do some damage to your car, and that's the end of your race. But what we see at the moment is these huge car park-like areas, and drivers can, you know, really attack a corner knowing that if they overcooked it a little bit, there are no consequences.
Exactly.
It is a frustration. It's a very difficult topic to discuss, isn't it? Because as you've suggested, the spectacle and the danger of Formula One racing are, they seem to be linked, perhaps not inextricably, but there's a sort of correlation there. And it's neither of us are saying that it would be great if Formula One drivers were at more risk, you know, if there was more peril, more harm. But I think consequence is the right word.
Okay, I think it would be massively better if drivers were at more risk of retiring from a race by making mistakes. Absolutely, that should definitely happen. I did some research into this quite recently, and the ratio of retirements. Now, obviously, cars are more reliable now, but also people aren't retiring because they're going off the circuit and coming straight back on again. So yeah, maybe that's the way to say it. I think it should be much more risky for drivers to risk retirement by leaving a circuit than it is at the moment. There should be consequences. And absolutely, to reiterate, neither of us are suggesting for a moment that we want drivers to be hurt or anything else, because that would be clearly ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, consequence is the right term, and consequence is what's lacking. We're not going to get stuck into this now. From sim racing, you know, there's no consequence there. That's why there's no heroism in those who do it especially well.
No, but it is fun. You know, I can absolutely, you know, and we're not going to go down sim racing because I've already had enough of the kicking bit of it. But it is, as, you know, even I who've done it a tiny little bit and really very, very poor at it, you know, as a thing to do, it's fun. But, you know, Formula One has to be more than fun. It has to be a sport. It has to be, you know, it has to have a certain... I was about to say gladiatorial, but that sort of brings death back into the arena. But it has to have that level of peril, of at least retiring from a race, for it to be interesting.
Yeah, you have to feel like you're watching a group of people do something that you could not comprehend doing yourself. Okay. All right, well, since it is the 70th anniversary season of Formula One, we should look back, I think, a little bit and wonder, you know, who have been the titans of the sport over the years, or who have been the sort of unsung heroes. Who springs to mind when you think of the greatest F1 drivers of all time? You've already mentioned Hamilton is on that list.
Lewis is on that list. And, you know, I think the more I've seen of Lewis, I think, you know, would he be in... I think if you ask most people who knew about the sport, maybe not now, because sometimes, you know, you need a bit of history, you need a bit of time to look back on a person's achievements. It's like a car takes a bit of time to become a classic. And maybe people at the moment don't necessarily appreciate just how good Lewis is. But, you know, he is special in a way that, you know, so, you know, is he up there with Senna, in my view? Absolutely. Is he up there with Fangio? Was he up there with Clark? I don't see how you can prove anything you like with statistics, and you know in statistics, Fangio is the greatest ever because he did 51 races and he won 24 of them. So he basically won almost half of the races that he did, and no one's ever got anywhere near that. But then, you know, if Giancarlo Bighetti won the 1962 French Grand Prix, okay, in a Ferrari. And the reason I mention it was, it wasn't just his first Formula One race for Ferrari, it was his first Formula One race. Yeah?
Wow.
He'd never done a World Championship Formula One Grand Prix before. If he then thought, well, it's never going to get better than that, I'm retiring. Yeah? He would have a start-to-finish ratio twice as good as Fangio's. But we wouldn't be sitting here and saying Giancarlo Bighetti was the greatest driver that there'd ever been. We'd be sitting here saying Giancarlo Bighetti got lucky because the record shows that he went on and did loads more Grand Prix and never won another one. So
it has to be a judgment, doesn't it?
It has to be a judgment. And you also have to factor in, you know, look at Sterling. You know, Sterling was his own worst enemy in many ways because, you know, the reason he didn't win multiple world championships is because he drove the cars he wanted to drive, which weren't necessarily the cars that were best placed to win world titles. You know, he was very keen on driving British cars, and he was very loyal to teams that, you know, couldn't provide him with the machinery that he needed. You know, and, you know, okay, to me, Sterling, and I know he was a friend of mine, so it's difficult for, you know, me to be objective about it. And I know I talked about this in the podcast about Sterling, but, you know, the fact that in 1958, he spoke up at the appeal of Mike Hawthorn for being chucked out of the Portuguese Grand Prix and got him reinstated, and that's why he lost the World Championship. That, to me, is... Or, you know, Peter Collins, you know, gave his Ferrari to Fangio so that Ferrari could win his fourth championship, thinking to himself, well, you know, I'm a young lad. He was in his mid-20s. I've got years and years and years to win my championship, whereas Fangio's a bit of an old boy, so, you know, we'll let him have his moment in the sun. To me, it's guys like that who don't win world championships but behave in a way which, to me, is the behaviour of a true champion, who, you know, we should be thinking of on these lists as much as anybody with... You know, multiple world championships who, you know, clearly, you know, nobody who ever won a world championship wasn't a good driver. But, you know, someone like, I would say Hawthorn, for instance, you know, he won one race in 1958. Sterling won four. And Hawthorn was world champion. So, you know, is he a worthy world champion? Well, maybe. Was Sterling a worthier one? In my view, undoubtedly.
It's a very good point that you make, because taking that very one-dimensional statistical view of it means that, actually, in many cases, we are rewarding quite sort of reprehensible behaviour. You know, I think Michael Schumacher, for instance, Adelaide 94, wasn't it? Running Damon Hill off the road. You know, that is not the behaviour of a true champion, somebody that we should all idolise. And yet that contributed to his career statistics. So there is something in that. We actually don't.
Senna running Prost, yes, off the road at Suzuka. I mean, you know, Senna was, you know, of people who raced when, you know, I was a grown up, Senna was, you know, in terms of, you know, I massively admire Lewis, but I wouldn't call him a hero of mine. Senna was a hero of mine. But even I'm not blind to the fact that, you know, he behaved appallingly at times. And yes, absolutely, you know, that championship in particular, like Michael's was in 94, was tainted, no question about it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and then you sort of have to continue on this thread and you think, well, okay, who has contributed, you know, even more to Formula One, and who's sort of spoken of issues much bigger than Formula One as well. I think we're seeing Lewis do that at the moment.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He's making waves in an incredible way with everything he's saying about the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, slightly more closely related to Formula One, so Jackie Stewart, a real champion of improving safety in this sport, even at a time when it wasn't a very fashionable attitude to have.
Yeah, but even Jackie, and I know this, sorry to butt in, even Jackie thinks it's gone too far.
Oh.
Okay? And I know this because a few years ago I interviewed him for actually something which, well, 8 years later, it's going to come out this year, but I'll bang on about that at another time. Yeah, even he, you know, he's the greatest single campaigner for safety in Formula One, a man who has, I think it's something like 25 garden benches outside his house, each one a memorial to a friend of his who died in the sport. And the work that he did and the lives that didn't get lost because of what he and a few others, Graham Hill as well, did to promote safety is never to be underestimated and is a massively commendable thing. But even he thinks that the racing has become too sterile now. Sorry.
No, that's very interesting to hear. Okay, well, I think we can begin to wind this one down now. But I want to hear do you think was the greatest single drive in Formula One of all time? I think I'm going to go with the one that springs to mind right now is Lewis 2008 Silverstone, in his second year in Formula One, and it was a torrentially wet race, and he was the only one who managed to keep any heat in his tyres, in his brakes, and he just romped off and he won the thing by a huge margin, while his title rival Felipe Massa had five spins. And I just remember watching that race live and going, oh my god, we've got someone here.
Yeah. I've always struggled with this because it's so difficult to do across the eras. I can offer a few though. I think the one that most people, certainly, you know, who sort of been at it for a bit, would say is Fangio at the Nürburgring in 57, where after a pit stop he was just like ridiculously miles behind the two Ferraris of Hawthorn and Collins, and he just drove like a man possessed, broke the lap record every single lap, and overhauled them, and it was his last ever Grand Prix win, and it was the last ever Grand Prix win by Maserati, although nobody actually knew that at the time. One of the ones that I, just in terms of a stat, or just in terms of a fact to get your head around, Germany 1968 at the Nürburgring, Jackie won it, okay, in a Matra, by such a margin, but by the time the bloke who came second came over the line, Jackie was in the grandstands watching the race. He won by 4 minutes. Okay.
Wow.
So, you know, he got
around that place.
So, I mean, that in terms of just utter dominance, that was incredible. Obviously, there was Senna at Donington in 1993 in the European Grand Prix. Although Rubens Barrichello in the same race, and nobody really thinks about this, actually overtook more cars. What else have we got? Italy 71. Six cars passed the finishing line, all within 0.6 of a second of each other. And it was the first race which had an average speed of over 150. Villeneuve and Arnoux at Dijon in 1979. If you haven't ever seen that footage, you will have done. But just go Dijon 79, Villeneuve, and just watch those two at it. In fact, neither of them won. They came second and third. But probably the greatest singles racing duel I've ever seen in Formula One. Where else? Actually, I could do a few more. But the one I want to point out is Canada in 2011, Jensen. I mean, if you look at what he had, six pit stops, he was last in the race twice. After the second of those times, he overtook the entire field, you know, including Schumacher, including Vettel, and and won the race on the last lap. I mean, in pouring rain. And you know, Jensen was always such a, although he did take out Lewis in that race and also clouted Alonso, he was always such he drove with such feel and in marginal weather conditions as there were that day, like few others have ever been. You know, that was just a time when no one could get anywhere near him, and he literally overtook the entire field pretty much twice to win that race. So yeah, that's got to be up there too.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary performance. Well, you've listed some amazing highlights from across the decades there, and do you know what? That is why I will be tuning in to the 2020 season, because I know that it might only happen twice or three times or maybe only once, but I know that at some point while watching a live Grand Prix this year, I will leap out of my seat and go, oh my God, I cannot believe what I'm witnessing. And that's why I give away all those sunny Sunday afternoons and why I get up at 6 a.m. on a Sunday, you know, to watch that. That's why I do it, just for those moments that I know I'll be talking about years from now.
I am exactly the same. I mean, I have been, if anybody from Formula One ever read what I wrote, which I'm sure they don't, they would be so bored of me because I have moaned about it for so long. But the fact is that, you know, come Australia, 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever it is, I'm just up, I'm there. Every single one I watch. And, you know, and at the end of a particularly dull season, I always get to the last race and I think, well, that's it, I'm never doing this again. But I always do. And you're absolutely right, because just occasionally, and I would actually say in the last couple of years, we've had some pretty good races, you'll get an absolute cracker. And when Formula One works, it is absolutely outstanding. And I think, I think that Formula One can go a lot further than it has, and I hope that it does. I hope more private teams come in, and if that means big teams like Mercedes and Ferrari move out, then so be it. But I think that with the budget cap, and hopefully with these change in technical regs, and more than anything else, with the change in leadership at the top of Formula One, I think that there is, let's be optimistic, let's say that we hope and believe there is reason to hope that the future of Formula One is brighter now than it's been for a while. Don't let us down, guys.
Yeah, bring it on. Well, that was fun. I enjoyed having a chat about Formula One again. It's been too long. Okay, well, let's leave that one there. Please do remember, everybody, that Drive Nation is now on Patreon, patreon.com/DriveNation. There's also a link to that in the description of this podcast, and you'll find another link on Drive Nation on Instagram. That's @DriveNation_. If you would like to support us each month with just a little bit of money, it makes a huge difference, and we're enormously grateful to everybody who has contributed so far. Last thing to say is, please do remember to like this podcast, give it a rating wherever you can, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That really does help us. And we'll make sure we talk to you again next week. And by then, we'll know who's leading the 2020 F1 Championship. That's exciting.
That is exciting. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so let's leave it on this. You think it's going to be Max?
I do think Max, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go Leclerc.
Ooh, this will be fun.
It'll be Lewis, won't it? All right. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. We look forward very much to catching up with you again this time next week.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.